This Sunday edition of the Dunkdown Basketball Podcast is brought to you by J. Cole for Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film. The Grammy-nominated hip-hop star's second HBO special, which debuts Saturday, April 15th at 10 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific. This exclusive presentation is a multi-narrative show that combines music performances with intimate interviews documented through Cole's lens. The special showcases songs from his fourth album, as well as revealing footage containing the heartfelt confessions, concerns, and struggles of people in the South. Traveling through different cities, gathering interviews, Cole reveals the challenges lower-income residents face trying to obtain viable housing, as well as the frustration for felons being barred from voting. Tune in Saturday, April 15th, 10 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific, for the premiere of J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film, exclusively on HBO. All right, Sunday edition here. We got a big show coming up as the playoff picture continues to evolve. Just two fantastic games today that we have to talk about. Russell Westbrook with that crazy buzzer beater ending the Nuggets playoff hopes and setting the record for most triple doubles in a season with 42. And then Atlanta coming back from 26 down to force overtime and eventually win against Cleveland. We got to wrap up where the playoff picture stands after the weekend's action. Also want to talk a little bit about Dame Lillard's 59-point performance against the Jazz last night, which is one of the great performances that I've seen in person up in Portland. Before we get started on that, though, I want to remind you that we are sponsored today by Blue Apron. Use the URL blueapron.com/capspace to get your first three meals free. And Indochino, use that capspace code to get any premium made-to-measure suit for just $389 with free shipping. All right, what a day of games this was, Danny. Really, one of the more enjoyable days that we've had in quite some time. Three games that went down to the wire, including the Lakers winning their fourth straight and killing our under on their over-under in the process after we said we both had that locked up last week when we did that. But I think we should start first with just where the playoff picture is after some of these games. In the Eastern Conference, Toronto was down three at halftime, came back to win 110-97, overcoming Willie Hernan Gomez's 20 points in the first half against New York. So the Raptors have won. The Wizards did not play. They are now locked into the fourth seed. What were some of the other significant results that we had today?
Atlanta over Cleveland, you already talked about that. That basically moves them kind of into a separate group, probably with the 5 and 6 seeds, them and the Bucks, which we still have plenty of drama there. And then really the rest of the East, kind of the bottom part of it, stayed pretty quiet today. But it's unusual in a way that basically almost all of the East playoff teams that still have something to play for have games on Mondays. So we're going to see a lot of movement and a lot of things change. And also the big story of the weekend is also that the West is pretty much set now.
Yeah, in the East, Saturday's action saw the Nets beat the Bulls 107-106. I think they came back from down 9 with about 4 minutes left. The Nets and the Lakers both really on hot streaks right now, amazingly. The Celtics got a big win in Charlotte over the Hornets, officially eliminating them. Paul George continued a recent hot streak as the Pacers down to the Magic. I sound like one of those old like sports radio announcers, like scores on 20 and 40 past the hour. But all this is important just to catch you up on kind of where we are and what the significant results were. The Magic continue to not impress, shall we say. And then the Bucks clinched a playoff berth with a 90-82 victory over the Sixers, and the Heat kept their hopes alive via a 106-103 win in Washington. James Johnson was key at the end of that game, and then Hassan Whiteside blocked Bradley Beal's three-pointer to tie it late. That's one of the losses that locked the Wizards into the fourth seed now with 48 wins or two games behind Toronto. The Clippers in San Antonio, even though the Spurs played most of their guys, had another nice win. The Clippers have dominated the Spurs in San Antonio this year. They had a big win over them early, and that combined with the Jazz losing 101-86, a game that I was at that saw Dame Lillard score 59 points. He had three free throws at the end, missed two of them. He could have gotten 60 right at the end there if he hadn't missed those two. But so with that all being the case now, what is it looking like in the West going forward?
So we know all four playoff matchups. It's going to be the Warriors against the Blazers, the Spurs against the Grizzlies, the Rockets against the Thunder, and then the Jazz against the Clippers. And the only thing we do not know is who will be hosting that Jazz Clippers series. The Clippers have the tiebreaker and they have even records right now. So the Clippers have to be the favorite. I would say they also have a substantially easier schedule, especially now that the reporting that the Jazz are going to have some of their good players out against the Warriors at Oracle on Monday. But so the Clippers have Houston and Sacramento both in LA, and the Jazz have the Warriors, as I mentioned, at Oracle, and then they host the Spurs on the last day of the season.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see whether the Spurs play their guys. Pop said that they will be playing everyone in Portland, a game that now means nothing for either team with the Nuggets loss today. On Monday, we'll see what happens there. Danny Green has been out for a time with a quad injury. He'll be back. Spurs are not really playing well lately, and I think that might be of some concern to Popovich that he wants to get them kind of back into things. But yeah, whether they'll play their guys in that game in Utah, we don't really know. And Utah may even rest their guys too, because as you mentioned, Derek Favors and Rodney Hood, both of whom played Saturday, will be resting against the Warriors, who will have their full complement most likely tomorrow night. And George Hill and Gordon Hayward are both potential to play. I think they're both questionable. Hill missed his sixth straight game with a groin strain. We saw him warm up before the game, was only really going about 60-65% speed there. And then Raul Neto also is out. He played a great game when he was in there against the Blazers and then suffered a really severely sprained ankle. I would imagine he's going to be out, you know, probably through at least like 2 weeks or so, because that was an ugly sprained ankle that he had. So with the Jazz being undermanned, and this will now be the, if there were to be a preview of that Jazz Warriors series, we'll have not seen the Jazz at full strength in any of the games this season. So you have to imagine the Clippers really would have to go 0-2 for the Jazz to have a shot. They're not going to win against the Warriors tomorrow, very likely. So it's looking very, very, I mean, I would say probably at least a 90% chance for the Clippers. And one win by them will really wrap it up. And they got the Kings on Wednesday. So it's looking good for them. And
do you want me to take an attempt at explaining where things are in the East?
Yeah, let's do it. That's a little more complicated.
It is a lot more complicated. So we know six of the teams, the Cavs, Celtics, Raptors, Wizards, Hawks, and Bucks are all in. That we know. That's about all we know. And the Wizards are the 4 seed. They're the only set seed in the entire East playoffs right now, with 3 days left in the season. With their loss today, the Cavs and Celtics are tied in terms of record, but Cleveland holds the tiebreaker there. They each have 2 games remaining, so basically Boston has to finish better than Cleveland to get the 1 seed. On Monday, Cleveland plays at Miami, and the Celtics host Brooklyn. And then on Wednesday, they're each at home, Cavs against the Raptors, and the Celtics host the Bucks, a rematch of an interesting game you and I watched a couple weeks ago. Boston has an easier schedule. I think a lot of this is going to come down to what happens in the Cleveland-Miami game on Monday, which I'm going to watch intently, probably from Oracle before the start of that game. There still is a chance that Toronto, who does not play until Wednesday, could make their way into the 2 seed. It depends on a couple of the ways that, like, basically teams would have to lose out and tiebreakers and all that sort of stuff. But they're probably going to be the 3. Then on the bottom half, I'm not even going to go through the tiebreakers.
Let's finish up. Up with one thing on the top. And Cleveland, LeBron played 44 minutes in regulation. Kyrie Irving was over 40 minutes in regulation as well in that loss. They're going to be on the second end of a back-to-back, but, you know, they may not want to play Miami, or maybe they do, and we haven't heard anything about resting yet. Ty Lue said he's going to play his guys until the number one seed is wrapped up, so we wouldn't hear anything about resting probably until Lue's media availability tomorrow, because they are not going to have a shoot-around or anything like that. But I mean, I think the Cavs are probably going to try and still go for the number one seed to have home court over the Celtics. That's, Lou said it was a priority. And Miami, if they lose that game to the Cavs at home, they're almost certainly done. And so that's going to just be a massive, massive game. And then the other intrigue is that Cavs-Toronto game, because there could be a situation where if the Cavs win, they could get the number one seed over Boston. And so Toronto, if they don't have a chance at the 2, which they would obviously fight for, but if they don't have a chance for the 2, they might say, hey, we're going to be the 3. We don't want the Cavs on our side of the bracket. Let's just lay down completely, let Cleveland get the number one seed, and then we will get to play Boston in the second round instead. So there's going to be a lot of intrigue among those top 3 teams in the East. How does it look now down at the bottom?
At the bottom, you have, based on their shocking win today, the Hawks took a lead on all of the other teams for the five spot. They're at 42-38. I'll just do it in the win column. They have 42 wins. The Bucks have 41. The Pacers have 40. And then the Bulls and Heat are at 39 each. And Chicago has that tiebreaker, should it be 1-1, over Miami. Part of the reason I didn't want to go into tiebreakers is that when you get into multi-team ones, it starts to change around the order. And so we'll know a lot more, since almost all these teams, except for Atlanta, all of the other teams play Monday, Wednesday. We'll have a very good idea on Monday night / Tuesday morning of where this is all going. But right now, there are just so many options based on all these teams sliding on Monday for us to know exactly where it's going to turn out.
Yeah, I think that the Heat, Albert and Ahmad tweeted out just what their specific scenarios are. Basically, they would have to win one more game than either Indiana or Chicago to make it in. And whether that's them winning twice, I mean, or the Bulls or Pacers losing twice and Miami losing once, Miami finishes up against a Washington team at home that'll have absolutely nothing to play for other than just getting 50 wins in the final game. The Bulls, they play Orlando at home tomorrow, which you would think is an automatic win, but it is the Bulls. Dwayne Wade came back, did not look very good, certainly defensively, was better on offense in his return from that fractured elbow against Brooklyn. And then the Bulls finish up then with Brooklyn at home again. So in theory, an easy schedule for the Bulls. And then the Pacers are at Philly on Monday and then have Atlanta at home. That Atlanta game, Atlanta will have something to play for. Although, again, there could be a little bit of jockeying on their side as well. I mean, maybe do they like the Wizards better as a first round opponent? They're not going to have home court either way. Do they want to avoid the Cavs, which I certainly think they do? They probably might feel like they have a decent amount of confidence against Boston, whom they beat last year, or against the Raptors, who they've played well against at times in the past. So that'll be really interesting as well, of where the Hawks want to be. And then you mentioned that Boston-Milwaukee game on the last day of the season. The Bucks play at home against Charlotte in a game where Charlotte, of course, will again have no incentive to win. So yeah, as you mentioned, a lot fluid. It should come into a lot more focus tomorrow. And I guess we'll probably have to, even though we're going to be at Oracle, have to do a wrap-up of all those games. So looking like a late night for the Dunktown Boys tomorrow night.
One other team that just has a large import over the next couple days, Charlotte does not play in the last game of the season, but in the next 2 days can have a major impact on the playoff market if they want to, because they face Milwaukee and Atlanta in a back-to-back. So if they win one of those two games, it could completely swing the bottom half of the East. I don't think they will, but they could.
Yeah, you would certainly think that they would just be resting Kemba Walker at that point. All right, let's get into a wrap up of this amazing Russell Westbrook game. But first, from Blue Apron, we were both in Portland all week. I certainly missed Blue Apron. I'm sure that you did as well. And it's a shame that we did, because we could have had spiced cod tacos with mashed avocado and a romaine peanut salad. That sounds like it would have been fantastic. Or lemongrass and ginger turkey burgers with marinated radishes and roasted sweet potatoes. If you don't know what Blue Apron is, it is a food delivery service that pre-portions out every ingredient perfectly, only as much as you need to cook, so there's no food waste. That's also how they help to keep the cost down. It's less than $10 per meal per person as well, which really, if you think about it, if you're going to a high-end grocery store, especially when you consider that you're going to end up buying more food than you need of some ingredients, you're probably going to spend more than that, and you're going to spend a bunch of time shopping for the ingredients. Blue Apron, it shows up on your door with free shipping once a week. So the way to get started with Blue Apron, go to blueapron.com/capspace. That is a custom URL for our program. That'll get you your first three meals free with free shipping at that /capspace URL, which is, of course, easy to remember because we talk about capspace all the time on the program. blueapron.com/capspace for the first three meals free. And of course, let them know that you came from us. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So this game was totally ridiculous. Denver didn't have much in the way of playoff chances after Portland won on Saturday night. They were down, I think, to below 5% chances. They would have had to win out and have Portland lose out at that point. And Portland did have a game at home against New Orleans on the final Wednesday of the season, which, New Orleans isn't trying too hard at this point. But this was yet another example of Russell Westbrook he's had 6, 7, 8 games like this. I don't know how many, but in the final 4:30, when OKC trailed by 13, they outscored Denver 18-4. Westbrook had 15 points, and he also assisted on a Samaje Christen three, which allowed him to get the triple-double and set the record. How is he doing it when, I mean, everyone should know it's coming at this point that he's just going to shoot every time down 5 minutes?
Remember that he had a couple of good passes in this game. He had an assist, which got credited, but he also had a pass when the Denver team basically entirely focused on him where he kicked it to Steven Adams and the ball just went through Adams' fingers and went out of bounds. So, you know, there is a line where he will pass it. It's just that it's not often, and he's able to pull up basically at full speed, so teams don't know exactly where he's going to do that from. And then you could think about that last shot. They did a perfect job defending that, and it just, you know, they got beat by a 35-footer.
Yeah, maybe not perfect, but it was really good, which is rare for Denver, which is an awful defensive team. I think we can get in shape here for the playoffs a little bit by going through, pick up the play-by-play here. Denver, as I mentioned, was up by 13 with 4:33 left on a Emmanuel Mudiay layup, and he has played well actually since he returned to the rotation, as Jameer Nelson has struggled with a calf injury. And that's when the impossible, the amazing happened. I had no idea that fans like cared so much about seeing this triple-double record, but I guess ESPN has been hyping it up enough that all the fans were aware of it. I mean, in Phoenix, where they were deliberately fouling to prevent the triple-double from happening, and then here the fans were really fired up. And so Wilson Chandler, as he should have, didn't guard Samaje Christen, who's 10 out of 58 on three-pointers. Russ went downhill, made the right pass to the corner, and Christen was as wide open as you'll ever be to hit a three-pointer. I mean, it's pretty hilarious that, you know, who knows how long his future in the league will be, but the one highlight that he will be shown in forever is him hitting a three-pointer, and that's like the skill that's like preventing him from being good in the league.
It is pretty amazing. And as much as you might want to say, oh, don't help off the strong side corner, when a guy's making 17.2% of his threes, it's not entirely the same thing. And now Chandler's help will also be on that highlight as much as it's shown. Though I don't think, especially considering it wasn't even the definitive highlight of the last 5 minutes of this game, I don't think that's going to be, you know, the Hank Aaron home run or anything crazy like that. It won't be the moment that lives in infamy for those for Chandler, or, you know, the legacy shot for Samaje Christen.
Yeah, so that made it 101-91 after that three, and the fans obviously were very fired up. The OKC broadcast crew was very fired up, saying that he basically had cemented his path to the Hall of Fame, which I think, frankly, like, if he just keeps this up another year or two, he's there anyway, so it doesn't matter. But really what they were doing, we don't have to go through every play, but it was basically Russell Westbrook, Steven Adams, pick and roll, and it just, Jokic, no chance at all, really, of contesting Westbrook at the rim or getting out on the floor. And so Westbrook had a couple of plays where he just was able to drive right by Jokic. Westbrook is not the greatest finisher at the rim when there's actually a contest, but Jokic not really able to provide that, get his body in front. And lest we take a little bit too much away from OKC and just say, oh, they're just give it to Westbrook, they're not doing anything, there are a couple of strategic elements. Number one is that Billy Donovan is very comfortable going with a very defensive-oriented lineup down the stretch of these games. And as we noted when we talked about OKC's clutch performance, their clutch defense was really good. And part of that is just that Westbrook can create his own shot at any time. And so you can get away with Steven Adams, Jeremy Grant, Kyle Singler in this one instead of Robertson, who looks like he might still be struggling a little bit with that knee injury. Singler actually hit a couple of shots in the first half, but he's not really a threat. And Samaje Christen or Victor Oladipo, I mean, there's no shooting in that lineup. It's not a good offensive lineup. And yet they're able to stop people and then just trust Russ to score on the other end.
It certainly helps when, as happened at one point in this game, the opposing team sends a couple guys to the offensive glass and then opens the floodgates for Russ in transition, which Denver did. And he had that beautiful Euro step. I think that was around Gallinari.
Yeah, that was really nice. Again, I mean, Denver just had nobody who could possibly provide any help defense that was going to make Russ feel them. And Russ overall had 50 points, I think 15 boards and 10 assists in this one, his third 50-point triple-double of the season. And the other thing that we really can talk about too, in terms of like some of the strategy that's been done, I mean, it's definitely like very blunt force, but there are some subtleties to it. One is just they run the ball down your throat, even when they're down, even when it's in clutch time. A lot of teams like to just slow the pace down, make sure that they get something. You know, they're trying to beat you down the floor. Another one too is that they have had deploy some subtle actions. I'm not sure whether this is Donovan or just something that's happening naturally, but screening the help. For example, on one play late, I think it was the one where Jokic picked up the flagrant foul, Russ just drove past Gary Harris, who was guarding him, and Adams saw that that was happening and then just turned around and screened his own man, Jokic, to prevent him from getting into help position. And then that's how Russ was able to get past Jokic, and Jokic had to commit the flagrant foul. On another play, it was the same type of thing where Victor Oladipo screened Jokic as the pick and roll was occurring. So he again was late getting there. So there were some things that they're doing other than just, hey, Russ, go get us a bucket. What did you think of the flagrant foul call on Jokic? That, of course, was a key play.
I think that the league can do a better job of emphasizing things that are basically an unnatural risk to the guy. I don't like it when somebody is committing contact with somebody who's already in the air and who doesn't really have a chance of affecting the shot. Like, it wasn't much contact, but it was body contact that wasn't really affecting the shot.
He gave him a forearm to the chest and was clearly intentionally trying to foul him to stop the play, and then he picked up a technical after that.
The technical,
as well, I think, just for
without knowing the full context, it's always hard to argue technicals because there's an element, generally it's audio, that we don't get to experience. But I think that when you give a guy a flagrant in that context, it might be a little bit much to give the technical to. But we talk about there are some elements of player safety that the NBA has not done a good job of. For me, that's moving the cameraman back, a few other things. But, you know, the block charge is another obvious one. But I'm good with taking a renewed emphasis on not fouling a guy in the air when you're not making a play on the ball. I'm totally fine with discouraging that conduct.
Yeah, I think so. And what they always complain about is, oh, the guy fell down hard, you made the call. He didn't really fall down that hard, but it was really the contact that was dangerous contact that really could have just sent him flying into the cameras. You know, and also just the fact that it was like the standard is unnecessary contact. And that's what that was. You know, there really was no play there to legitimately stop him. That's one where you want to encourage players to just let the guy go instead of like injuring him. You know, so Russ makes all three free throws there. I mean, it was surprising. I mean, he was only 1 out of 4 on threes during this last period, but did go 6 of 6 from the line. One thing I noticed, he had the 15 points on the end. It seems like in all of these crazy comebacks, there always ends up being a three-shot foul that ends up being really important. And you can say, all right, you know, don't foul. That's a really good idea. But also, it's impressive that Russ was able to make all of his free throws. See, actually, I mean, I don't remember hardly any clutch free throws that he's missed in his career. I think he's an excellent clutch free throw shooter, just, you know, by my subjective recollection there.
Yeah, that's a good point. And do you want a crazy stat that I just looked up because I thought of it and felt like sharing?
Yes.
There have been 5 50-point triple-doubles this year, 3 by Westbrook, 2 by Harden. Counting it since 83-84, because I think that's just the way Basketball Reference does it, there had been 0 of those in NBA in those years before now. And there had only been 6 45-point or more, so basically between 45 and 50, triple-doubles, and there have been 7 of those this year. So there have been more of those this year than had existed in the other one since 83-84.
What did you think of like Denver's offense late in this game? Because to me, I didn't think it was that bad, but OKC was successful switching. They took a couple of shots a little bit quicker, but I didn't think it was like so bad. You know, they had Gallo had a couple of bad turnovers. He actually had 34, 20 in the third quarter and then failed to score in the fourth. But, you know, I think they got some penetration. They're trying to run the clock down. I didn't think it was that bad. I thought OKC just eat them up pretty well.
It was fine. I thought that, you know, even on the play where Gallinari had to basically chuck it to avoid a shot clock violation, that was good defense by Oklahoma City to prevent them from what they wanted to do in the first place. So I don't begrudge that necessarily as being bad offense. And yeah, a couple times they went a little bit earlier than, you know, could have been. I actually think that, you know, it was kind of a weird, their last possession was a little bit disjointed, but overall I thought they were fine. Like this was not a situation of Denver's offense losing them the game.
Yeah, it really was, again, very good game management. I mean, I guess they only had 4 points in the last 5 minutes, so you could say that, but it wasn't one of these ones where like, okay, all they were doing was just running it down and ISOing. But it was tough for them because Oklahoma City was switching a lot of stuff, and Denver has a wonderful offense, but guys who can just go one-on-one is something that they are not necessarily a wash in.
And that's something to watch, because now that we know who they're facing in the playoffs, if they switch a lot against Houston, the Houston is very limited in terms of, unless they're they're going to play Lou Williams in crunch time of guys that can create one-on-one.
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably just be Harden it every time, you would think. So after Wilson Chandler was called for an offensive foul, which I thought was not actually that bad, Oladipo took the charge. And to his credit, I mean, he was looked like he was really laboring out there after he had taken a charge on Gallo in the third quarter. He got kneed right in the chest, and he actually took or tried to take two more charges late in this game. Good by him. I mean, he really didn't, you could tell he didn't have the juice off the dribble. He wasn't moving well, I think, as a result of that. But nonetheless, he took that charge, and with 29.4 seconds left, OKC did a great job of getting the 2-for-1. They ran an out-of-bounds play with a zipper cut. It actually went to Russell Westbrook, surprisingly enough. And he curled off the screen and then just went right at Nikola Jokic. I think if you're Denver there, we have seen a ton of teams. The only team really that has tried to take the ball out of Russ's hands late and that succeeded was San Antonio in that game in the last couple of weeks. You know, they didn't really react to Russ. He got ahead of steam and just blew past Jokic, and he scored in 2.3 seconds. So they got the 2-for-1, and while Denver did a nice job of running it down, they got a Jamal Murray drive. He tried to dish it to Jokic, who couldn't handle the pass, and then Jokic missed a floater after retrieving the loose ball in the corner. Westbrook got the rebound, and they got a timeout with 2.3 left, and you know, that was another play where they had switched everything. Murray did a nice job to get penetration against Steven Adams, but they just couldn't convert. And Oladipo again did a great job of stepping up for a potential charge, forcing Jokic to miss his floater, which he usually is pretty money at.
So then that set up the situation. I think it was about 2.9 seconds. That's what I remember. It's what's in my head about that. And since the Thunder had a timeout left, they were able to advance the ball. And it looked like Denver was actually, one of their goals was trying to not allow Russell Westbrook to get a shot in a reasonable range, and they succeeded at that part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I would have even like tried to react to him even more, but the strategy that they had was to switch everything, and the play design was pretty nice. They started Westbrook up top, and they basically ran three guys in a wheel pattern around Steven Adams. That brought Westbrook all the way down to the baseline, and then he did a zipper cut again up to the top. Jamal Murray switched onto him expertly and actually forced him so far out towards half court that if they would have inbounded it to him directly, he probably wouldn't have even been able to get into shooting range in time, because he was basically almost running into the backcourt. So they did a nice job to throw it into Steven Adams. Russ, great movement off the ball, shook Murray just enough. And then Mason Plumlee, who was guarding Adams, didn't quite have the awareness of how much time remained because he was trying to sort of meet Westbrook closer to the three-point arc. If he had been up in Steven Adams' grill, then maybe on the handoff, he could have reacted to Russ or just left Adams completely and just let Adams shoot a 30-footer himself to try for the win. But Russ was able to get open, a quick jab cut, went to his left, and incredibly made the shot. It was listed as a 36-footer on the play-by-play, and his ability to just rise up, the power in his legs, he shoots that ball really easy from that far out. And while he's never going to be a knockdown shooter, his ability to get a shot off at any time when he's hot is something that is really just about nobody else in the league is able to do that.
This is a small, you could argue, trivial point, but I personally enjoy that after having a chance to set the triple-double record in the game against the Suns, I personally enjoyed that Russ did it in a representative performance, and he put a much larger stage on this game when it didn't, at the moment he got that pass to Samaje, it didn't necessarily look like it was going to be that game, but it turned into it, and it created an overall moment. And while I personally feel that the MVP, and we can't talk about what the voters are going to do because it's hard for us to know unless we have connections that I don't think, at least I do, that he was able to put that all together in a moment. And while you want people to be on your side of it for the whole time, if this is what gets people on board, hey, I'm fine.
Yeah, and I mean, the amazing thing was he's done this so many times this year now that you expected that they could make a run by ramping up the intensity. He also ramped up the intensity on defense. He is an excellent switcher. That's part of why that strategy works pretty well. I mean, he doesn't have the greatest attention over the course of a full game, but down the end, especially against, when you're not facing like a Golden State or something, he actually can be pretty effective because he has enough strength to hold up against bigger players. So got a little bit of pushback on Twitter lately on our MVP pod, saying that we shouldn't put any emphasis on Westbrook's clutch performance because that clutch performance is pretty random. And yeah, and we said as much on the show, that if you're trying to determine who the better player is, and you're also trying to determine what their performance is going to be going forward, you would definitely want to de-emphasize the small sample size of clutch performance. But this actually happened, right? And then other people were like, oh, well, you know, what about like if you scored 10 points in a row earlier in the game and then, you know, that put the game out of reach and then it never even got close? Like, shouldn't that get equal weight to clutch performance? And the answer to that is no. It doesn't add as much value because you're taking a situation where your team, let's say it's tied in the second quarter and you go on a 10-point run. Your team has a 50% win expectancy there, maybe more if you're a good team. And now you're moving that up to, you know, I mean, you're not, it's not going to be 100%, but to, you know, increasing your win expectancy by whatever it is. Russ is doing this in situations where their win expectancy is like 2%, 3%, 5% in a lot of these games. And, or maybe more than that, but certainly they're down and he's leading incredible comebacks completely on his own. So you're adding much more in terms of your chances of winning the game when you're having a clutch performance like this at the end. I mean, that shot that he made that took them from, you know, probably like a 15% win expectancy, probably even less than that because they're only down two, to winning the game. You know, that's like you just boosted your chances of winning the game by 85%. And I'm eyeballing these numbers. But yeah, it means more in the clutch. Now, it doesn't mean more necessarily going forward, although you could make the argument too that they really kind of have a system here that all of these games fall into a pattern where he just goes into a frenzy offensive attack. They throw as much defense on the floor as they can. We've made the point that we think a lot of comebacks really start with defense more than they do offense. And this kind of allows that formula to happen. So maybe there is something a little bit more repeatable about just the way that he's doing this than just, you know, hitting a bunch of buzzer beaters would, because it's over a longer period of time. Nonetheless, I don't think you'll be able to repeat this over next season, for example. But this did happen. It did add wins. It is value. It's the most valuable player. It's not the best player. That's why we have focused on that. And remember, this is also just a tiebreaker. It's not, you know, oh, he had this clutch performance and, you know, he didn't play as well. I mean, it's, everyone is saying it's too close to call among those four guys. And so I think this is a reasonable tiebreaker.
Sometimes I get frustrated when your piece gets to the point I was going to make right at the very end, because I was just going to talk about the idea of best player versus most valuable. If the award was player of the year, that would certainly matter. Like, it would be a factor, but value is a very specific proposition. And while it is somewhat a nebulous term, win expectancy is a good way of putting it, because it is a tangible impact. And also, people talk about, oh, you know, getting 10 points to help seal the game. Usually that team was going to win that game in the first place. If they can lock it up in the third quarter, that's not changing a loss to a win. That's doing something that's, you know, making a probable win into a definite win. And that is a notable accomplishment. I mean, that's something that we have talked about in prior years in terms of Stephen Curry and other things. But what Russ is doing is entirely different. I mean, this was a game, and so was the one against the Magic, where they were down double digits inside the last 5 minutes. And the even against
And so was the one against the Mavericks. I mean,
against the Magic and Nuggets, both of those were on the road. I can't remember if the game against the Mavericks was too. I think that was in OKC.
Yeah, and there was one against the Lakers earlier where they were down 10 and they ended up losing on the road, but they were down 10. He brought them back to tied 5 minutes left in the game as well. CJ McCollum had a good tweet. Thanks, Russ. You the real MVP because beating Denver put Portland in the playoffs. A few other notes on this one, and I'm sure we'll talk more about Denver and where they go from here in the future now that they're out of it. But Mason Plumlee had some okay defensive moments in this one against Enes Kanter, but on the defensive glass, they got abused when he was out there. He just is trying to do way too much still. He's emboldened by this whole put the ball in his hands and now he can have some assists. He tries to drive in. They try to throw it to him in the post on switches. He's completely ineffective there. He'll turn it over a lot. He is a really bad finisher, which was a major problem in the third quarter as well. So it just, we've talked about this before, but I don't think that as a major player he's the answer. I mean, if he wants to be, if they can sign him for like backup center money, yeah, bring him back. But if they're going to overpay him, you know, they're going to pay him well into eight figures per season at age 27 when he's only going to be on the downslope. His finishing is only going to get worse as his explosion declines. His defense is only going to get worse. I'm not into it, frankly.
Oh, I thought of this during the game, and I just think it's It's a little bit salty, but at the same point, I wanted to ask you the question, and blindsiding is way more fun than asking it the way I was going to before. Let's take out the 2016-17 salary out of the equation, just because that's a little, makes it a little too complicated. Moving forward, would you say that, so like at this moment, if you were allowed to make trades, would you rather have Enes Kanter or Mason Plumlee in terms of trade value?
Oh, Kanter, I think pretty easily, especially because like Kanter as a backup, you can get away with him.
That's what I was thinking about as well, just in terms of the talent evaluation part of the Nuggets trade. I'm not saying that was on the table. Obviously, it probably wasn't.
Sure.
But the idea of Mason Plumlee being this guy was such a strange concept, because if he is that guy, then you're going to have to pay him and you don't have a spot for him. And he's not that guy in the first place. So yeah, the horse has been dead a long time, but still.
All right, we'll get to that crazy Cleveland-Atlanta game in which the Cavs blew a 26-point lead in the fourth quarter momentarily. But first, this from our old friends at Indochino. I worked as a lawyer for a long time when we went to court. We had to wear suits. And I wish I had known about Indochino back then, because my entire wardrobe would have been Indochino. Instead, you know, when I was just like first out of law school, I was going to like Men's Warehouse. Then I went to like some nicer department stores. And, you know, eventually at one point I got a made-to-measure suit that was like well over $1,000. Throw in all the tailoring costs of the department store. I was getting pretty close to that for some of my suits as well. God, what a waste of money that was. Because Indochino can give you a made-to-measure suit using the CapSpace code, of course, for just $389. And frankly, they did a better job of fitting me than this custom place that I went to in San Francisco. You can go into one of their North American showrooms, or you can measure yourself. There's a tutorial of how to do the 14 different measurements on their website. Send it in, and 3 to 4 weeks later, you get a premium suit that's yours. Hundreds of fabrics, hundreds of patterns. You can customize the lapels, the pleats, the jacket linings. Get it monogrammed if you want to. And when it arrives, it'll fit you perfectly. So kind of crazy that I have all these dollars sitting in my wardrobe, and the two suits that I like to wear the most are my Indochino suits. So the way to get started with them, again, use that CapSpace code at Indochino.com. Get any premium suit for just $389 with free shipping. And you never have to worry about badly fitting suits or expensive trips to the tailor again. Get ready to look like $1 million at Indochino.com. Promo code CapSpace. So this game for three quarters went absolutely according to script until it didn't.
It was 93-67 at the end of the third quarter. And what was striking to me about this, beyond the haywire officiating, which I'm sure we'll talk about, was usually when a team has a comeback of this scale, you think of the idea that really everything went right for them. You know, the other team missed shots they almost always make, and they were just hitting.
Yeah, I had the same observation. Yeah,
they were unconscious or something like that. That is not what this game was. Like, this was, I mean, the Hawks played well, and the Cavs did miss some things there, but this was not the best of times, the worst of times. This was an entirely different thing, and I was dumbfounded by it, considering how great Cleveland looked earlier on.
Before we get it, well, actually, we can talk about this at the end, like how we see Cleveland after these latest foibles here. But how did this happen? Well, Mike Dunleavy killed Kyle Korver defensively. Dunleavy had a bunch of quick points, came off screens. Korver committed a three-shot foul. He just lost Korver, even though there wasn't any contact on the screen, for another three. He went backdoor on it a couple times. One time he got a layup. Another time he set up a corner three by Mike Muscala. Mike Muscala caused big problems for Kevin Love, who was playing at center. Love, generally, when he plays with Tristan Thompson, will guard the other team's center, and Thompson will guard whoever can shoot on the floor. Muscala just hung out in the corners, and Love, always a mediocre help defender to begin with, wasn't able to get there as well, not to mention getting out to the corner on some of these Muscala threes. And then LeBron James really he's been fantastic in clutch games all this year. I mean, Cleveland, another team that's really outperformed their point differential as well, and he just had some really weird brain farts pretty late in this game.
Yeah, the last couple minutes, I think, were a closer to the description that I said of a standard kind of blowing a game late. There were a few plays where Cleveland just didn't really do much offensively, and then LeBron, it was two turnovers towards the end of regulation, right?
Yeah, so, and that was sandwiched around fouling Paul Millsap on a three, and he made all three free throws as well, which was a clear foul by LeBron. There was And the crazy thing about this, not only was there a 26-point lead, the Hawks got it back within like 13. And then Kyrie Irving hit a ridiculous three from like 28 feet. And they were up 105-88 with under 6 minutes remaining in the game. I mean, it's just, we've seen so many of these absolutely statistically unlikely comebacks lately. I mean, I think coming back from 17 down with under 6 minutes left is even more impressive than the 26 down at the start of the fourth. And there just were all kind of mental mistakes, like Iman Shumpert fouled Malcolm Delaney, like just running down court for one reason. They just ran totally mediocre offense, running the shot clock down and then going into their small pick and rolls with, you know, eight on the shot clock. And then that didn't leave enough time really, if they did get the switch, for the guy to really attack very much. So the offense just was really bad, really simple. The Hawks had no trouble stopping it. Paul Millsap did a great job defensively. He also really hurt LeBron James offensively. And then finally, though, it still looked like there wasn't going to be a problem for Cleveland. And then they had a 5-second violation after they advanced the ball, and they still had timeouts left. LeBron was the inbounder, did not call a timeout as he was in his 44th minute. And the Hawks did a nice strategy. It looked like they were going to get Kyrie Irving open. And then they actually had Bazemore, who was guarding LeBron, go and take Irving coming towards the ball. And then they had Irving's man switch onto LeBron and try to get into his vision. So you're not leaving the inbounder open as much. So you're almost adding like another switch element in where the guy guarding the inbounder can also switch onto someone. And that's how they forced that 5-second violation, which the Cavs said it was really fast. It was not. I counted it. It seemed like it was a pretty good 5 seconds there.
And then there was also the issue of that was on a different play, but of I'm trying to think of all the elements that have made Cleveland fans aggrieved about the officiating in this game, because the play the jump ball.
Let's get to that. We'll go in order because there's a few other things.
Sure.
So then down four, the Hawks go for the quick two. Tim Hardaway Jr., who had a nice game, was effective running pick and roll, especially in overtime. LeBron just shoves him in the hip on the drive, pretty clear foul. And then we mentioned how, you know, it wasn't like the Hawks were lights out. Like Paul Millsap missed a layup with like 3 minutes left. Bazemore had a wide open corner three under a minute left that he missed. Hardaway missed one of these two free throws, and Irving then got fouled in the inbounds. They're actually made both free throws. They're up five with 10.4 seconds left. And then they inbound to Millsap in the corner, and LeBron is right there and just fouls Millsap on the elbow. He makes all three free throws. And then there was again, another example in one of these comebacks of like a bad three shot foul being critical. He makes all three. It's a 2-point game. And then at that point, Atlanta is going to be in trouble. There's only like 6-7 seconds left. I think they had one timeout left, maybe. And they just forced a jump ball in the corner. And it was actually, again, LeBron's fault, because they ran a nice action off of the inbounds. Kyrie started all the way up at the free throw line, extended on the far side of the court, sprinted off a screen, got going. He had the advantage. And then LeBron threw the pass like way too far into the corner. Kyrie had to change direction, go get it. And then he got tied up in the corner. One of LeBron's complaints was that he tried to call timeout as soon as that happened, and that Leroy Richardson, the official, didn't recognize it in time, and then gave what LeBron thought was a ridiculous explanation, which was basically, you know, I couldn't tell who had possession. But if you actually look at the replay, when LeBron turns to him and signals for timeout, Richardson is already like kind of got it, craning his neck down to try and see along the baseline whether there is a tie-up situation or not. So it was completely understandable to me that he wouldn't want to give a tie-up when he couldn't be sure, or they wouldn't want to give a timeout when he couldn't be sure whether the tie-up had already occurred.
I have no problem with that. Exactly. You know, you don't want to be overly, you don't want to be overly touchy and give away a timeout when possession. I mean, I can remember
And also, I don't want to bail someone out with a timeout. Like, you better be damn clear that you got that timeout in.
Sure. Absolutely. And also that ended up being called a tie up, and their fans were up in arms about that both Millsap and Bazemore were out of bounds. There is a picture of it. One of the challenges with a tie up in all that situation is, I'm not saying the call was correct. I would need to see a different angle from what we saw. Not saying that at all, but when a tie up is called is the important part. Like, basically when it is identified, not where they are kind of as it gets whistled, just like a lot of other other things where circumstances can change after the initial call.
Yeah, and it's not even clear in that photo, you know, whether the whistle had blown already or not. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's as someone who's refereed at a low level before, you know, it's the same thing as like when you're braking a car, when you see something come into your path, there's going to be a reaction time. But, you know, generally when you're caught, when the tie up has occurred, could be earlier than that. So it's difficult to say. I mean, probably it was a missed call there, but you know, probably, again, yeah. This was the reason that happened was because they failed to execute like time and time again. And specifically on that play, LeBron failed to execute. He just threw a really bad pass. So, you know, I think when you're the one who put yourself into that situation to begin with, like with a specific bad play, you know, I'm not as receptive to like that kind of complaining.
Agreed.
And then, so the jump ball between Irving and Bazemore, no one really got the tip. It kind of just fell next to him. And Mike Muscala, who had a wonderful game, this was like a true 50-50 ball, beat Kevin Love to it, and then was able to get it to Millsap, and Millsap hit a sweet fadeaway almost behind the backboard on the right baseline to send it in overtime. We should probably talk too about, you know, what the Hawks lineup was here down the end of the game, because two of their stalwarts, of course, were not involved.
Yeah, I mean, so Millsap was of course the one who was involved, but Kent Bazemore was an interesting, I think that his defensive role, like, should these teams, I don't think they're going to play in the playoffs this year because the Hawks actually might have ensured that that won't happen by actually winning this game. Tim Hardaway was strong and right now, and so Dunleavy was on the floor
for
that
Howard
stretch.
And no Schroeder though,
right.
was what I was alluding to there. Yeah,
right. And both those guys didn't play in either in that stretch or in the, because I mean the Hawks, it gets lost a little bit in the shuffle, they won back-to-back games against the Cavs.
Yeah, that's right. On Friday, they spent a complete skeleton crew, didn't bring any of their starters, and they beat the Cavs with the Cavs playing at home with their full contingent after everyone was like, oh yeah, they killed the Celtics, so they're fine now.
Yeah, and then Schroeder and Howard, to be clear, they did play in this game. They just didn't play in this stretch.
Right, right. And really, the only starter that they brought back was Millsap. Down the end, there was more controversy, though. First, Millsap, quote-unquote, fouled LeBron as Cleveland went to a nice ATO that they like a lot late in games. They'll throw it to Kevin Love at the elbow and then have Irving set a back screen for LeBron. And Love threw a great bounce pass to LeBron. LeBron missed the layups. He missed several layups in the fourth quarter in overtime that were, you know, plays that you would expect him to make normally. But Millsap was called for a foul. He didn't touch him. And then the next time down, LeBron got called for pushing Millsap in the back, going for an offensive rebound. That, again, was also a pretty dubious call. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of that. But at least that one, you know, it looked like it prevented Millsap, if there had actually been a push from getting it. There just wasn't a push. So it seemed like it wasn't one of those ones where it's like, oh, it bounces to the other side of the floor and you're going to call the loose ball foul anyway, yeah, like they do in college.
It's a bad call, but it's a reminder also of why, you know, the accumulation of stuff matters. Because if LeBron hadn't picked up that, first of all, if LeBron hadn't picked up that fifth foul on Millsap shooting a three, the game wouldn't have gone to overtime in the first place. But second of all, he would have had an extra foul so that if the refs blew that call, he would have still stayed in the game.
So with LeBron, yeah, and LeBron, I think, had another kind of weird foul too in the fourth quarter.
His fourth, yeah.
Yeah, with LeBron out, Cleveland still led it by three. It took Atlanta almost 3 minutes into the overtime to even score, and they finally did, but then it really like was back and forth. They got a three for Korver out of a timeout. Malcolm Delaney got knocked down by Richard Jefferson on what looked like a pretty clean screen to me. And then Bud, instead of going back to Schroeder or Jose Calderon, just went with no point guard at all, had Tim Hardaway start working in pick and roll. And Hardaway was able to set up a three in the corner by Muscala, who again did a great job of relocating. The pass was not on target. And he again was kind of behind the backboard. Kyrie Irving, of course, was burned repeatedly in pick and roll defense on a lot of these plays. And then there are also two very controversial charge plays. One, Love was called for a charge, and then that was overturned because the man was in the restricted area. I think it was Millsap, and they ruled that the play didn't start in the lower defensive box. I agreed with that overturn. And then Kyrie, when they're down by three, decides that he, with 30 seconds left, gets a wide open three and pick and roll, gives it up, goes to the rim, makes the bucket, and Millsap was gifted an absolutely ridiculous charge. When Irving had picked the ball up, Millsap was like two slides away from where he eventually finished, and it just just a garbage call, like one of the worst charges of the year. I say that every day, but
and people, like, one of the most frustrating parts about this is the idea. Sometimes people look at different parts of it. They're like, oh, he was set when the contact occurred. That is not the threshold for whether it is a charge or not. He was like, in this case in particular, he, first of all, he wasn't set when the contact occurred. He was still moving. Second of all, when, as you said, when Kyrie gathered, he was miles away from where the contact occurred.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you have no chance to avoid the charge in that play if you're Irving, because like the guy isn't in front of you when you make the decision that you're going to take off. Like, how are you supposed to avoid that? It's why it's such a ridiculous rule. All right, anything else in this game, or can we talk a little bit more just about how we feel about Cleveland now?
There was also a botched inbound that ended up being important. I think Love was trying to throw it to Kyrie and just missed him, and it was a little bit too...
And then Bazemore almost missed a wide open layup too after that one. That was the play right before Kyrie passed up the three and got the charge. That's right.
Yeah. Right. But no, that was all I wanted to say.
This may sound odd after like another disaster by the Cavs, and now, you know, they're looking like getting the number one seed. It could be kind of difficult depending on what happens in this Miami game, that it's got to be killing Deion Waiters that he's probably not going to play in. But nonetheless, they've shown enough of a ceiling even over these last 2 weeks still. I mean, this blowout of Atlanta in the first three quarters, what they did to Boston last Wednesday, that while you do worry about their consistency, especially on defense, they still have shown the ceiling to be the Cavs. You know, if they were just playing poorly and like playing bad defense, but also like the offense couldn't explode and like they really were looking bad that way, then I'd be more concerned. But I still think they have to be significant favorites in the East playoffs. You know, just kind of losing concentration, blowing a 26 point lead on the road, or like just not trying that hard at home against Atlanta. I feel a little worse about them than I did a week ago after that Boston game, but not much.
For selfish reasons, I'm a little bit disappointed that's your take, because it's very similar to my own. And Cleveland, the ceiling, as you said, is the most important part of this. They've had a couple of good defensive stretches. That was a big concern, and it would be nice if they did it more often than they have. And I'm still a little bit concerned about making sure they're 100% for the playoffs. I think that'll be fine, but we just kind of need to keep an eye on it. But the bigger issue, and I've talked about this before with both them and the Warriors, is that while the teams around them are good and they're better than they were last year, I mean, obviously not the Spurs in the Warriors case, but anyway, I'm not sure they're specifically better to face the favorite. And Boston is really, their offense runs around one guy. Washington relies a lot on John Wall for their shot creation. They have other guys, but a lot of them are dependent talents. And then Toronto, we just haven't really seen it very much. They've had so much trouble with the Cavs in the past. So Cleveland is weaker. The opponents are stronger, but the threshold is enough. And I don't think opponents are stronger enough and the Cavs are weaker enough for me to really start to fret that they're going to be the finalist. It's possible. It's always possible, but I don't think it's likely right now.
So I want to talk a little bit about Damian Lillard's 59-point game that I saw in person on Saturday night. Have I mentioned I was there, by the way?
Yeah, it's not making me bitter at all. Not at all.
Well, you got to see that rousing Warriors-Pelicans game.
Ah, it's my job. I understood the risk that I was undertaking, and you know, that was, we'll talk about Durant probably tomorrow, I guess.
Well, at least you got to eat at a Furry before we left, because that's where we had lunch on Saturday. So you didn't miss out on a new Portland.
I missed out on getting that amazing broth the second time. Oh man.
In any event, it was really an incredibly remarkable performance for Lillard. He had 26 in the first quarter, 0 in the second quarter. Now, granted, he usually sits for the first six minutes or so of the second quarter. Then he had a further 20, I think, in the third quarter, and then he played the entire fourth as well. And by the end, they were just running pick and rolls with him every single time. And poor Shelvin Mack and Dante Exum just had nothing for him. Like, Exum early on just wasn't strong enough. Dame was actually like getting to his spot and then exploding through him for layups at times. Shelvin Mack is just way too slow to even think about keeping up with Lillard. Going under was not an option for this one with Dame. And then they put Raul Neto on him, and Neto actually was plus 13 in pretty short minutes and actually started the second half because he was so good defensively. And then he sprained his ankle 2 minutes into the half after playing some great defense on Lillard at times. Lillard still just hit like a ridiculous fadeaway step back three from the right corner over him, but he was doing doing a great job at keeping him out of the middle and competing, getting over the screens, quick feet, you know, despite being not your typical physical profile for a good defensive point guard. I think he's actually really good, and he has been since he came over. So that's a loss for the Jazz. But back to Lillard, he ultimately scored 59 of their 101 points, which is absolutely ridiculous. I was a little disappointed in the Portland crowd, actually. I thought the crowd was better in that game we were at on Thursday against the Wolves, because they didn't give him like any kind of standing ovation until he hit like yet another ridiculous step back three in the fourth quarter and got fouled, and then he had to like exhort them all to stand up before they finally did. But then they were good after that for like the last 2 minutes. It was just a little bit of an odd vibe on a Saturday night, but it showed me why the people who are like, oh, like they should move Dame and like build around CJ instead. Like CJ just doesn't have that level of explosiveness, and not only from a scoring standpoint, but Dame just gets downhill so quickly that he just forces help and then he opens up everything else in the offense. Whereas CJ, he works to his spots, he's got some moves, but a lot of times it's just step back mid-ranger, which he can make at a higher rate than nearly anyone in the league, but he's not drawing help to where he can really make you change your scheme that much, make you double team the ball, open things up for everyone else. But it was a weird game because the Blazers shot terribly. Nobody else had more than 12 points. CJ was 4 out of 20, and yet Dame was just absolutely on fire. And a big issue for the Jazz, the Blazers only turned it over 3 times. The Blazers have been doing a good job not turning it over, but the Jazz good defense is really undone by the fact that they are not forcing turnovers very much. You're always going to have a ceiling on your defense if you don't force turnovers. More in just Derek Favors looked okay offensively, not as good defensively. He did not play a single minute with Rudy Gobert. So I don't know whether those guys are going to start together. Boris Diaw looked awful, just was not able to get a rebound, was not able to defend. I really just think that they should just be starting Favors. And granted, Favors, you know, is injured and is coming off the bench, so that may not have been possible. But in the playoffs, I think they really need to start him and then just not even really play Boris at all. Go with the Joe Johnson or Joe Ingles or Gordon Hayward at the four. Alec Burks continues to really struggle. Like if George Hill doesn't come back, they're going to be in big trouble, especially with Neto out now. So a little bit of a disheartening loss for the Jazz, but they were on the second end of a back-to-back. They didn't get in until really late the day before. They had just beaten the Wolves the night before in what had been a hard game. So maybe just part of their lack of juice was just the fact that the schedule was catching up to them a little bit.
My concern, and it's been this way for the Jazz, is just that we've seen so little of them at even anything close to full strength. And so they're going to need it against the Clippers, because the Clippers are a very good team at when they're at full strength, and they have plenty of playoff
experience. Clippers are playing well right now, too.
Yeah. So,
under the radar.
And the Clippers are very likely going to have home court in that series, so Utah is going to have to sneak at least one at Staples, and that's not the hardest task in the world, but they still will need to actually do it. And they're going to need George Hill, not only just because he's so central to their team, but because they're facing Chris Paul. And if Neto is out, he's been one of their nice stability pieces, even after I enthusiastically traded for Malcolm Delaney in the mock off season because I thought he would help, on the mock deadline. But I like the Jazz. I still am a believer in their ceiling. I'm just becoming more skeptical that we're going to see it this season.
Yeah, and Hood, he looked okay too. I mean, I probably am a little bit too down on the Jazz after this game, because Favors looked like he was all right. Hood actually scored pretty well in the second quarter, like looked like he was able to play. I was surprised that Snyder never went with Burks or Hood or Hayward on Lillard, but you know, I guess he just felt like they needed those guys for offense and didn't want to wear them out. The Clippers, we mentioned them, second in the NBA in net rating behind the Warriors over the last 10 games. They've gone 8-2, 9.9 net rating. Third actually is the Blazers with also a 9.9 net rating, although some of that was accomplished with Jusuf Nurkic. The Blazers going 8-2 really down the stretch here, because I mean, they were 11 games under 500. Like they looked totally dead at one point. For Portland, Myers Leonard was booed pretty mercilessly. Actually, they probably showed him mercy after a little bit, but enough that Marv discussed it on that TNT game on Thursday for missing some threes. He came out and hit his first two, and that really changed everything. Stotts, I thought, in an inspired decision, started Leonard to match up with Rudy Gobert, bring him out on the floor, and then he also started Noah Vonleh, and Noah Vonleh was fantastic defensively. They were switching a lot, and the Jazz were only 1 out of 6 on field goal attempts where they attempted to ISO on him off of switches, and the one that they made even was not like a good shot. Like he was great. So Leonard, I mean, I'm not going to say that like he's turned some corner after hitting a few shots, and he had some ugly moments later in the game, but it was enough to really mess up Rudy Gobert a little bit. And I think if I were Portland, where you got to kind of go with some riskier strategies, I might consider, assuming Yusuf Nurkic isn't back, and it's, and we didn't see like Nurkic working out pregame or anything to where you would think that he's anywhere close to a return, which is understandable with that injury. I might try Myers Leonard, see if he can get some quick buckets early in that matchup against Zaza Pachulia with the Warriors, or JaVale McGee when Steve Kerr insists on playing center. And then, you know, when once they go with more mobile centers, that won't work, but you might as well take advantage of the matchup and Kerr's orthodoxy early in those games.
Particularly since David West is not allowed to play in the first and third quarters.
Yeah, I still think the Warriors probably are going to need to start him at some point. Maybe they won't need to because they'll just blow through anyway. But
have I told you my idea with this?
Best guy. Let's hear it.
Play David West the first 4 minutes or so. So start him each half, play him the first four so minutes, then pull him when Iguodala comes in, go with Draymond at center for a few minutes, yeah. Then go with whoever they want at center, kind of when either when Draymond sits or however they want to do it at the end of the quarter. JaVale's actually done a nice job in that spot a couple times recently. And then you can still use David West in his normal place. If you did that and just played him 4 minutes at the beginning of each half, he's still within his range, probably beat about like 16 minutes a game there. And he's a much better fit, not only against Portland, but theoretically he challenges the Clippers in different ways, and I think he could challenge the Spurs in different ways as well.
I completely agree with you, and he's playing better. I mean, I understood the idea of like wanting to bring him off the bench, ease him in, not tax him too much in terms of minutes. He's not he's pretty undersized as a center, though he has the big wingspan. All right, we're getting far afield here. This game, though, 59 of their 101 points, did remind me of the greatest game I ever saw in person in that regard. It was in the 1999 NCAA tournament in New Orleans, where I was going to college at the time. Wally Szczerbiak scored 43 of Miami Ohio's 59 points against Washington in a first round upset. And I think they ended up making the Sweet 16 that year, actually. But it was just a completely ridiculous performance. He was so exhausted afterwards. But I mean, to score 70% of your team's points like that was just completely nuts. Let's get to some news here, and then we can call it quits. I think we'll talk about the cap implications more on Tuesday, as well as the Nike Hoop Summit, since there aren't that many games that day, but a few other injury type of stuff that we got to get to.
It looks like Ryan Anderson is he's back basically now. He played a little bit.
Yeah, he was 6 out of 6 I want to say last night against the Kings. Maybe that was today that they played. I can't remember. Maybe he came back after whatever game he came yesterday. Back. He hit like, yeah. Yeah, he hit 6 out of 6 on threes, so not a concern really as much anymore. We talked about how with Sam Decker out, it could be a problem, but with Anderson back, that's not as much of an issue anymore. And, you know, I mean, he was hitting like 30-footers these last two games, so good to see that he was able to make his return. Matt Barnes, as soon as they got KD back, and again, we'll also probably talk about how KD looked at some point before the playoffs as well, especially once I get a chance to see him in person. But Matt Barnes suffered a foot sprain. X-rays were negative, but he was in a walking boot limping out. How bad did that look when it happened, Danny?
It didn't look too bad, and he is optimistic that he'll be able to play when the playoffs start. Kerr was optimistic after the game, so it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And, you know, you never know, and they're going to be cautious with him, just like they are with all these sorts of things, but I don't think it's that serious from what we know right now.
Tim McMahon reported that George Hill, with that groin issue, he's expected to return before the end of the regular season. Hill, you remember, turned down that extension offer from the Jazz that would have given him basically $88 million in new money over the next 3 years. So you would imagine that he is going to want to make sure he's fully healthy going into the playoffs, have a good playoff performance, see if he can beat that extension that he turned down. Rajon Rondo has been out the last two. He actually had been playing extremely well for the Bulls in the absence of Dwayne Wade. He was much better off with more shooting around it. With Jerian Grant has been playing in his stead, and the Bulls have had some ugly losses to the Knicks and Nets without him. I think he played against the Knicks, but he had this wrist injury at that point. So nobody really seems to know when he is going to be back. Also a note on that Lillard game that I meant to get to, scoring 58% of his team's points was the ninth such percentage of any game in the shot clock era. So that's how ridiculous that game was by Lillard.
Nice.
And then the Cavs made a transaction as well, waiving DeAndre Liggins talk is they may bring back Dante Jones again. They waived him at this point, so he could maybe get picked up by someone else and still be under contract for them. But Liggins actually started earlier in the season and then, you know, they couldn't hit a shot until they stopped playing him at that point in the absence of J.R. Smith.
And if memory serves, Liggins' contract is actually very favorable in terms of a team picking him up because he has a team option for next year. But even after the team option, his contract is only lightly guaranteed, if my memory is correct. And so that's very team friendly because you can go through that. I advocated on Twitter for Charlotte in particular to pick him up. They don't have a free roster spot right now, but they could clear one with just losing one of their guys like Brian Roberts, who's going to be an expiring contract anyway. So you can do it that way. And then you get at least an option for him because those teams that are close to capped out, getting somebody at the minimum would be a big help.
Yeah, and anybody can claim him too because he is on a minimum contract for two or less years. So
right. It's not like within the minimum ones. Exception.
Yeah, it's not one of those ones like where they had to use their mid-level exception to give him more than 2 years, and then only teams with cap space or an exception of longer than 2 years can claim him. But you know, we'll see whether he gets claimed or not. I mean, it's. You know, he did have that domestic violence incident, so that might be something that teams are a little wary of in certain markets where you haven't just won a championship. Last thing here, Stan Van Gundy in his third year of a 5-year, $35 million contract to be both president and coach is reportedly safe after this disappointing Pistons season. That per Vincent Ellis out of Detroit. Do you think he should be safe?
Sure. I think that he's done a good job of, at this point, of kind of finding value and getting guys on contracts without giving up much in return, and considering they don't have much in the way of cap space, that's what they're going to need. So why not? And he's a good coach.
Yeah, there is some talk that kind of coach is sort of passed the league by a little bit, but you know, you would say that Eric Spoelstra is from that tree. Thibodeau has not been as effective this year, but obviously was, you know, 3 years ago in Chicago. So yeah, I mean, I think he should probably get another year. I think overall his tenure, despite the disappointing season, even from a personnel standpoint, it has been a success. But yeah, I think if it's not working out by the end of next year and it gets to the point where he's demanding an extension and they haven't really taken a step forward to look like they're at least on the path to getting into being a mid-tier East playoff team, then they may need to make a move at that point.
I agree with that.
Yeah. All right, we done here?
Yeah, I'll promote a few things. So if you want to hear my thoughts on Durant's return game, I wrote about it for The Athletic. I podcasted about it for Locked On Warriors. And also I just released Real Jam Radio with Sam Vecenie, where we talked about the NCAA tournament's effect on the 2017 draft. And then we talked about the Nike Hoop Summit and the 2018 guys. So it's a mammoth 2-hour one. So you can break it off in pieces at various moments. But I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, for us, I mean, we're really going to start ramping up the Twitter NBA show. I'm sure Dane will participate as much as possible, but the current plan right now is just about every night that we're not at a Warriors home game, we're going to do Twitter NBA show. And I'm not sure what form that's going to take, what kind of stamina we'll have. I don't know if we can do both games and then also do the post game show as well and dunked on. That might just be a little bit too much to basically talk continuously for like 8 straight hours. But I think at the very least, what we'll try and do is the fourth quarter of the early game if it's close, and then all of the late game, or maybe switch up if the early game is a juicier matchup or something like that. But that's the goal, is to do it just about every night that there are playoff games, at least do one of those shows. Also probably do the Twitter NBA show post game if you just want to only tune in for that, if you can't really watch it and sync up. So keep your eyes out for those. Remember, you can follow me on Periscope at Nate Duncan NBA, or get a notification on the Twitter mobile app. Click on the little bell next to my name. If you go to my profile, you can get notified of when we do live video. Also, don't forget about our sponsors today, Indochino. Use that cap space code to get any premium Indochino suit for just $389. And Blue Apron, blueapron.com/capspace is the URL to get you your first 3 meals free. Talk to you all tomorrow night. Thanks again to this episode's sponsor, J. Cole, for Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film, the Grammy-nominated hip-hop star's second HBO special, which debuts Saturday, April 15th at 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific. This exclusive presentation is a multi-narrative show that combines music performances with intimate interviews documented through Cole's lens. The special showcases songs from his fourth album, as well as revealing footage containing the heartfelt confessions, concerns, and struggles of people in the South. Cole strives to provide a socially conscious platform for those who are most affected by current injustices and champions unique perspectives and shared experiences in the American South. So again, tune in Saturday, April 15th, 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific for the premiere of J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film exclusively on HBO.